You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 101. This minute begins with Shaw stumbling down the corridor and ends with the engineer's pilot chair rising from the ground. And I am once more joined by Eric Nash of Watchmen Minute and Almost Famous Minute. Hello.
Yeah, hey Connor. Good to be back. How are you doing?
I don't know why I can't say hello like a normal person. It's a running joke with me. Because I think in high school I was always like, hello there, like Obi-Wan. And it never ended.
I wish that had come out by the time when I was in high school or even college. And I would have happy to say that to everyone. It was way too geeky for work.
It's kind of come back a little bit, the prequel memes. So
yeah.
What was that, 2005? Yeah, so I was 13. So we recorded the first 2 minutes quite a while ago. But through the magic of podcasting and editing, it sounds like this is just the very next episode. But no, I had to look through my script and remember what the hell I was talking about. But I think I'm going to keep track of everything.
Yeah, it definitely had. I mean, you know, the stuff earlier on in the movie with David and his tendencies, his, you know, what he's doing with the Lawrence of Arabia, you know, stuff. And that kind of fixation thing he has. And I mean, and this other stuff with Vickers and Idris Elba's character, I forget his name, and
Yannick,
just their relationships. And
I keep calling him Luther in my script.
Yeah. Right.
Just default to that, I guess. I mean, it's a great show, but yeah, there's just so much to keep track of. And especially in this scene, got engineers, you've got 3 scripts, and we'll be reading that 3rd one today, and there's a deleted scene, and there's all the stuff Ridley Scott said about it, which never made it into the movie, so I don't know what's real anymore. So, the first thing I think of note is Wayland's death scene.
Yeah, right.
And he says,
"There's nothing."
I know. Have a good journey, Mr. Wayland.
And I never read this before, but that exchange is kind of ambiguous. Yeah, it's one of those ones where when you see it for the first time, you just go, oh, I mean, he's just realizing, oh, you know, there's no salvation, there's no ascension, and the engineers have nothing to give. They're kind of assholes, frankly. But it is very vague, and I feel like you could also read it as accepting death, that there is no afterlife. Although, you know, Wayland can't really know that for sure.
Yeah, right, yeah. That definitely was going to be a big point of mine. That, I mean, you know, okay, just being ready to die, how do you know? You still haven't crossed that line, truly.
He's very...
So...
He really deals in absolutes. Yeah. He's very much like, well, I failed this mission, so yeah. I guess I'll die, to quote the old man meme, and I guess there's no afterlife. I have no evidence for this, but I've just decided that's true because the engineers are assholes.
Yeah. And David's response back that I know, I mean, that's like, so that's, I think it's really just, whether it's in his programming or he's come to be this way with Wayland, you know, as a father, he's just saying that to be very comforting.
Yeah. Because it could just be this polite agreeableness. Or it really could be that, well, I mean, he is an android, so his concepts of belief and faith and all, he doesn't have that,
yeah.
I don't think. Even though he does have emotions and stuff, I think to him, he probably would go, yeah, I've always been an atheist and I always knew there was no God, there was no afterlife, so good on you, Mr. Wayland, you finally caught up. I guess... Wayland was perhaps imagining, you know, 2001 A Space Odyssey, he comes up a lot in this podcast, but he probably was thinking of, or hoping for, a being that is kind of divine, that crosses that line between living creature and something on a level above, like the aliens in 2001, they transcend the limitations of the physical body, of the mind, of everything. But yeah, no, engineers are just really jacked dudes, and that's it.
well, we have this great visual. That's a great old take back right to the very first movie with Ian Holm.
Yes.
Ash.
Yes, Ash.
I gotta go A, B, C, A is for...
yeah, A, B, C. And then Walter.
I loved when you pointed that out back when you were starting
this
whole project of yours.
Oh, faithful listener.
Way back when. I was like, that's wonderful. Yeah. A, B, C.
But then there's Walter that ruins everything.
Yeah, right. Yep. Oh, Walter. He does ruin
Maybe he's got like a surname or something that we don't know about. But yes, Ash, that Ash hole. He...
Yeah.
I think it really was a callback to him. Because, you know, you've got to tear the head off the synthetic. It's just tradition. But yes, we then cut to Vickers, who, to me, does seem a little sad to see Waylon go. She sort of has this kind of moment of silence. And then she says, you know, time to go.
The briefest moment.
The briefest moment. Just like, well, goodbye, old man. Anyway, time to go home, is all she says. And... this also makes me wish they'd used the extended version of her conversation with Waylon. You know, it shows this far more complex relationship that she once admired him and, well, couldn't stand to see him become old and frail. But that's the beauty of a deleted scene. You know, I can choose to believe that that's canon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of stuff in these scripts that it kind of makes sense on the surface, and then you stop and think about it and you go, hang on. But what is that actually saying? It sounds like it's saying something, but it's not.
Yeah. There's a lot of different movies that have crept in more vagueness at the end, so close to the end. And I mean, we have some that are right at the exact very end of like I think of about Inception or something. You know, at this point, gosh, you're looking for more answers, I think.
Oh, Nolan's a good example. Yeah. And we'll get to the next, well, the final script version in a minute, but that is a good point. Just how much of an answer, how much detail do we need to make this work? And they seemed really uncertain about that up until, I'm sure, shooting day, basically. Well, actually, no, editing. In editing, they deleted some scenes, so yeah, they didn't know what they were doing. Much like Star Wars, it was made in the edit. The engineer is seen drawing the pilot chair out from underground, and it is a really impressive moment. I think this is one of the most iconic scenes. You've got the music, the visuals, it's just, beautiful marriage. And I also can't even tell which parts are digital and which parts are practical. Like, obviously there has to be, because you're not building this giant structure that can move, it's articulated, but they built the entire chair, but they didn't build it so it's fully articulated and can come out of the ground. There we go, being clear.
Now, the thing I kind of wanted to point out about this room that we've been dealing with, you know, like three or four different times now between David and then the rest coming here, upon the initial watch, you know, I don't think I could tell you that I had an inkling that this could be that same, you know, cockpit room, you know. I mean, it has that other stuff. It has that other chair. You know, and from that chair, you get essentially the 3D map in order to navigate. But the chair was going to rise from the middle of this. You know, it's definitely very familiar now. I mean, I very much associate, you know, when David's walking around and finding that other chair, I now very much associate it with where they were, you know, in Alien.
I think because it's only now we're really seeing those angles, we're seeing those shots that are evocative of Alien. Whereas for the most part, I mentioned this ages ago, but the concept artists were told to not go too giga, which is weird because this is a freaking prequel. But they're looking at an artist called Gutelin, so there is this more... it's less airbrushed, more digital, if that makes sense. You know, you've suddenly got way more precision in how these things are made, and I think a lot of that has to do with how the concept art was made as well. So even on the engineer, his costume is way more precise, whereas the space jockey, it's big, it's bulky. I don't know if it's just a change in technology, you know, it's a different time period, but yeah, you make a good point. It really wasn't evocative of the space jockey until now.
We see... you know, the engineer getting ready to, I mean, it's going to, you know, he's going to be able to fly here shortly. He's going to fly from this, position. It's not just a gun. Is it a gun at all? Actually, I guess. What are their bullets?
I mean, those could just... It's like a telescope. It could just be sensors on the end, or something could come out of that. I would be more inclined to think it's more like just a captain's chair. It's just... Or a pilot seat, as it is referred to, where every control in that ship comes from, or every command in that ship comes from him. So, yeah, he's just basically controlling everything, including weaponry, but we've never seen that, so... Oh, the addition of the sort of holographic stuff, I think, is actually quite an elegant solution to... In the original film, we don't see any obvious signs of computers or interfaces or anything like that. So by making it this very subtle structure that isn't even invisible, until you activate it, I think was a nice way around that problem.
And it's definitely important that we see David kind of glancing over, getting a look at what the engineer's doing, because that's going to come in handy.
I love that shot. Oh, the white blood of synthetics, you know, it's such an iconic thing. But it's one of the... If you think about it, why? Why would he even need, especially that much? What is it doing? But it seems to have become this trope, almost, with androids in fiction forever.
Yeah, that they need anything similar, that's kind of similar, like a blood-type substance of any color, doesn't matter.
Yeah. I think Alien might have started that. I can't think of an earlier example of an android bleeding, or at least, you know, not in the sense of it's actually leaking fluids. It can pretend to bleed, like if it's Westworld. And then, yeah, the Westworld androids don't seem to need fluid. It's just, well, they've got blood, so when you shoot them or cut them, it's more realistic. And from the top of my head, I can't think of anything else. But I think it all wonderfully ties into that biological horror of Alien. It's just, it's not clean, it's gross, yeah. It's technically bodily fluids everywhere. And it's white, which is... It's gross to me. I don't know why. I mean, you could say, you know, it's semen, but it's also milky. I'm sure they were going for the semen. It's Alien. Of course they were going for a semen reference, probably. It's got to be all sex references all the time.
I want to say, just back again to Vickers, though, that her, you know, it's weird. It's, you know, this ambiguous vagueness nature of whether she cares or not. I mean, you know, it's right after the, you know, it's the long beep of the vitals of Wayland, and it's time to go home. And you know, so she's not, so she was staying long enough to know that he was dead. And then, then by that, you know, by that line of thinking, well, she doesn't care about the vitals of the other people that are probably still alive, especially, I mean, at least Shaw. I mean, I don't know about the one or two other.
We never really clarify what happened to them, because in earlier minutes you can see everyone's vitals at the top of the screen, but in this one, I don't think you can. It's just Wayland's. No, it's just Wayland's vitals. Okay, yeah. No, she didn't care. I have to wonder what would happen if they had just taken off and didn't even acknowledge the engineer's ship. Just, oh, well, he's going wherever he's going. Whatever. Oh, wait. He's tailing us. Oh, no.
Yeah, right. It's
a little harder to have a cataclysmic explosion in space. So I think that could have been equally interesting. I think he could have done it that way where everyone just ignores Shaw, and then you finally have that, or at least you're hinting at, you know, aliens on Earth, which is what they wanted to do for Alien 3 back in the day. Which, will I cover Alien 3? Don't know. I'm addicted. I keep just adding more and more MXM podcasts to the pile.
I think there's some people out there that are after that, because the guys that did Alien and then Aliens, and then kind of, they did do, I think, what, a quarter of the movie, like four chunks.
Yeah, they were doing like 15 minutes or 30 minute chunk. Yeah,
up for Alien 3, but so it'd be nice.
But nah, you got to do it in excruciating detail. I think that's definitely that. I love my favorite movies to do movies by minutes on is the ones that are controversial and divisive and it has a lot to give, but it also has some ridiculous decisions that don't make any sense, much like Prometheus. And yet I'm doing Blade Runner 2049, which I think is pretty perfect, and some people even say it's better than the first. The reason I'm doing that one is because it's so goddamn dense, and it's so complicated, that I need to just break it down minute by minute so I actually know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, so we have a third alternate script for this scene. I didn't include it in the last minute because I didn't want to overload it. There was a lot going on, and as I said before, I was having trouble even distinguishing between reality and pre-production script. So this comes from Lindelof's Prometheus script, which was presumably one of the last before the final shooting script. Although, this could actually be the final shooting script. I've been told that sometimes, in all the deviations we see in the final film, could have just been made up on the spot. They could have had writers there on the day just making up an improvised script, basically. There's another word for that, but I'm no expert. And yeah, this is one of the few scenes in this script that significantly deviates from the film, at least in terms of giving us a translation of what the engineer says. So this is page 137, if you want to check it out yourself. The engineer, angered by the hostility and tension surrounding him, explodes in a dramatic, almost Shakespearean display response to Shaw. Because of the complexity of its language, the reply takes nearly 3 minutes to complete. The engineer looks violently exhausted during and after the speech. That's pretty crap language, I'm just going to put it out there. Like, if it takes you that long to convey any idea, keep working on it. The last engineer says, "Hate? We gave you this emotion. We gave you all emotion. We had expected not of your evolution. We took care of you, gave you fire, built your structures. We gave you Eden. You worshipped us. We praised our creation from above. We watched you time and time again kill each other, start wars. We came back and saved your souls. But we left you to make your own fate. And your kind is a barbaric, violent species. We tried once more to save you." He's still gone. "We took a mother's child back to paradise and educated him, taught him the meaning of life and creation. We put him back into Eden to educate your kind, but your kind decided to punish him. We gave you the fruits of life, and you repay us by leaving it to rot. You talk of hate, prepare for rapture."
Wow.
Yeah, that's too much, I'd say. But that's fascinating to me that this is one of the last scripts, or the last script, who can say, and they suddenly went really overt, because in the last two, it gives us a little bit more information, but not too much. But I hate everything about this, you know, that we've got Space Jesus, we've got the idea that humans are all inherently evil. It's like, oh, you just deserve to die, all of you, for no reason.
I wonder if it's you know, it was the reasoning behind writing it out is to kind of put into words what Lindelof, maybe with Scott or without, I don't know, Lindelof and whomever, or just by himself, you know, just thinking, trying to put into words the motivations, the thinking that's in the engineer's head. And
that makes a lot of sense. Doing a lot of writing lately myself, I definitely have a lot of scenes that don't make it into the story, but it's just, what is this character about? How do they feel about this? And that does help inform the scene going forward.
It's kind of like a journal or diary entry, you know, of the engineers that...
Yeah.
That's what he thought about on his own. but him to voice it.
Yeah. It could also just be a way to give the translator something to translate and give the actor kind of something to physically perform. So he knows, this is what I'm trying to convey, so this is how I should behave to convey that without, you know, using English. This is probably the first example of early minutes I said, you know, who is the Prometheus in this story? And I know a lot of articles online or videos go, why would you call your ship Prometheus? That's just doomed to fail, you know. There's a lot of negative connotations there, but it's just, well, what if it's not the implication that the ship is Prometheus, but they are going to meet Prometheus, you know, the creator of human beings, giver of fire. And now in this script, the implication is, well, that's the engineer in this scenario, although that implies that there is a pantheon, that there are other gods involved, which is kind of cool. that aspect I could get on board with.
Yeah, the reasoning behind the title, you know, while I had a probably back, you know, when this came out, you know, I had a little bit of an understanding of it. I looked into it a little bit more, but didn't give it too much more of a thought until after. You know, I mean, it's not something while you're watching it that you need to really go over and, you know, in your head. I think you're going down the wrong path if you're, well, why'd they title this the for the movie? Why'd they give the ship the name? You know,
it's a nice word anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love the idea of the implication that there is a big, wide universe and there's other aliens out there, and you know, the engineers have probably seeded countless planets, but maybe there's a being above them. You know, I've always, throughout this podcast, kind of played around with the idea of, what if they're not actually gods, but more akin to angels? They're sort of this proxy, this channel between God and man, because they seem more like that to me, that they're tall, they're white, they've got this uniform appearance. Maybe they aren't even acting of their own accord. Maybe they are following orders. And that's why I love that there's no translation to what the engineer says. They made the right decision, that giving us the freedom to inject our own interpretation makes it much more satisfying, makes it much more exciting.
Yeah, I was thinking that, you know, yeah, a god above them would say to them, okay, engineers, you get to create beings in your image, kind of similar, a bit smaller, but what have you, different. Then, you know, you can't, you know, you'll then have to, if we agree that they're not doing what we want them to do, what they should be doing, then you're going to have to kill them too.
I like that idea. I don't think we see that in any mythology around the world, but the idea of God creates angels, they are these perfect beings, they are just an extension of his will. They're not technically beings unto themselves. But then God can say to the angels, well, okay, I think you've progressed, you've matured to a point where I trust you to continue to spread my creation through the galaxy. You know, you can create anything in your own image or whatever you want to do. You can go ahead and do that. And yeah, that's kind of fun, the idea of this experiment of letting the angels create life for the first time. And well, apparently it didn't go according to plan. And this is an idea, like, you put that idea in my head, and I've been thinking about this movie for 2.5 years, maybe? That's why I love movies by minute. They're really, most movies, I think, there's more going on there, or there could be more to think about than you just get out of one viewing. All right, so thank you for joining me for these 3 minutes.
Oh yeah, I was very glad to be here, and like I said, I was very into having some minutes with the engineers and our engineer.
Yeah,
for this movie, but I'd love to come back for a lot more. There's a lot more engineer stuff in Covenant.
Yeah, the scene where David bombs a planet. Yeah, we should do that. That'd be great. And where can we find you?
Yeah, so currently I'm hosting Almost Famous Minute. That's doing very similar to what Connor here is doing for this movie, for the Cameron Crowe 2000 rock and roll movie. And it's actually on the rock and roll podcast network called Pantheon Podcasts. And I have my other show where I'm a co-host of Feels Like Weezer with a great guy, Zach. And we're going through all of Weezer's catalog track by track in chronological order. So we actually have some. We're preparing for the doldrums of Ratitude.
I'm trying not to say anything about Almost Famous because obviously I'm going to be on there at some point. But I just love it. It's so nice.
Yeah, I think some of the people that really really love it even more than I do, that have seen it like hundreds of times or something. It seems like the couple of guests I've had on that have said that. I was like, wow, that's. I mean, I'm getting to the point where I feel like I've seen it 100 times, but. It's a comforting thing for them.
Yeah, it's like this. It's like an odyssey. It's this dreamlike. It's comforting.
Yeah,
it's
right.
It's absolute wish fulfillment. Like, what kid at some point in life didn't imagine, I'm going to run away from my boring life and I'm going to hang out with some rock stars? Like, that's, yeah. I mean, it's a universal dream, I think.
But don't do drugs.
Don't do that. I think I've got the plane crash, almost plane crash minute, so that's a long way away still.
Yeah.
Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on TriviaDesigns.com, Chia. You know how to spell it by now. Why do I keep saying it? You've heard it a million times. You know where I am. And Patreon.com/TriviaDesigns. I'd like to thank my Patreon supporters, Mark Boda, Tariq, William Elcott, Simon Haynes, and Gray Malkin.